Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today, I'm really excited to have a show speaking with a colleague who is like-minded. I think we talk on the show a lot about how our healthcare system has changed and how we as doctors and patients need to be on the forefront and take our power back, because it seems to me that it's been ceded in a lot of ways. People are telling us how to treat our patients. Patients are being driven by commercials and big pharma, but the doctor-patient relationship is one of the most important parts of the healthcare system. And in my opinion, it doesn't work without either one of us. So today we're going to have an awesome conversation with Dr. Amber Belt. She is a naturopath physician. She has a practice that is, I think, geared towards educating patients so they can be a partner in their care. And I love the fact that you, as an independent, self-minded professional, that you're about practicing medicine the old-fashioned way, where it's a calling. And you're not afraid to do that and to have your patients be partners in their care. And I think that's what makes you so powerful. So Dr. Belt, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you. It's truly my pleasure to be here. And I'm very excited to have a conversation with you today.
Well, I always ask when I speak with a colleague, because you think outside the box, and a lot of our fellow physicians have just gone lockstep in line with what's expected of them. How did you pull away and be your own person and be your own advocate for your practice?
Well, I think when I was trained, when I went to naturopathic medical school, it was almost 20 years ago. So at that time, we really were encouraged to think independently. And even in naturopathic schools, I've seen them sort of evolve to be more in line with, you know, with conventional medicine and be in lockstep with sort of, I don't know if the groupthink is the right word, but, you know, the conventional way of thinking about medicine and those recommendations that really, I mean, ultimately they disempower patients and they disempower us as doctors too. So I think a lot of it goes back to my training. And then, also during the pandemic, you start to see things happen that really went against my core philosophies as a naturopathic doctor. And I couldn't get in line with that. I couldn't fall in step with that. So I'm not sure if I'm particularly unique, but I think a lot of it goes back to my training and then my willingness to just see things as they are and then have other physicians who and patients who were willing to support that line of more, I guess, independent thinking.
I think patients have come through this whole process of the pandemic. A lot of them have come full circle, where when they come to the office, they're really more interested in finding the or treating the problem and not so much in just masking the symptom. I think we were kind of almost sleepwalking through this, where you give someone a drug and they take it for one or maybe more for the rest of their lives, and that's how it is. But there's no thought to what's the physiology. That's one of my favorite things when I was in medical school, was physiology, understanding the body, how the cells work, how the whole system is integrated. I've always found that fascinating. But in practice, you know, as you, the older we get, the more we, I think we have a just this wealth and this fund of knowledge where things stop making sense if you don't, if you just keep doing what everybody else is doing. And it's like, why? This makes no sense. And why are we medicating somebody instead of fixing the problem? For example, recently, I've had multiple conversations with patients who have weight issues, but no one's ever recommended a nutritionist or to change their diet. It's just give them a medication that they'll have to take for the rest of their lives. And I'm not sure they realize that they can't come off of these injectables, but it's just shocking to me that healthcare professionals don't have the, I don't know if it's the time or the mentality to be advocates for their patient. And why would you want to take something that doesn't fix the problem when you could make lifestyle changes and fix it? You know, does that strike you? I mean, are you seeing that when patients come to you? Because there seem to be highly motivated, educated patients that want to be a partner in their care.
Yes, I'm seeing my patient base generally, because I'm not a conventional doctor in that system. My patients have always leaned a little more that way. But I think in the last 3 to 5 years, I have seen more of those patients come in who really want to dig in and get to the root cause. They don't want to be on that medication, or if they have to be, if they need to continue that medication, they at least want to have their health foundations shored up so that they can maybe take a smaller dose or get off of 2 out of the 3 medications that they're on. So I do think people are a lot more motivated right now. And it is, I'm always surprised when a patient goes in with high blood sugar or high blood pressure that there's little to no talk about the basics of diet and exercise, which we know are so effective. But I will also say, in the defense for doctors, it can be really difficult to get patients on board to make those changes too.
Well, you know, I think maybe your mind's like-minded like me, but if you spend the time and explain why you need to make the changes instead of just poo-pooing it or denigrating your patient, like it's this, just do it. They're not going to. And nothing, I don't think worth doing or having is without work. You know, when you put some skin in the game, and I think if you treat the patient as an equal, I mean, you're educating, you spend time educating patients. And I think that's where the disconnect is. I mean, you're a teacher for your patients. You explain, I would think, the from reading about what you do, it's about becoming, teaching them the basics, but not in a way that's over their head or making them feel bad, but making them feel, oh, I get it. I understand why it works. Let me try it, you know?
Yes. I think one of the things that I do well as a doctor is I can meet people where they're at, because I think you can tell patients to, I don't know, to do whatever exercise or do whatever diet, but like you were saying, taking the time, meeting them where they're at and helping them make changes that are sustainable, even if it's slower than they want or slower than you want, as long as you're starting that educational process and getting them, you know, getting them engaged and helping them in that way, you're going to see a lot more progress. And then over time, you just build on that.
Well, it's a foundation, right? It's, you can't, you know, run before you can walk. And we don't really, I don't remember, well, I did have health when I was in high school, but I don't think we really have a facility with our bodies anymore. It's, you know, just the major pieces of what it means to be healthy and taking that kind of ownership of your choices instead of it's easy, you can nuke it, you don't have to cook it. You can go out. I mean, well, I think cost is probably a little bit prohibitive at this point. That was a treat when I was a kid. We didn't eat out. My mom cooked, and we had full meals, and we sat down with each other. But, you know, we might have had a TV dinner once a week on a Friday because it was like a treat, but it wasn't the standard. How did we go, do you think, from, you know, I kind of know the answer, but I would love to know your take on it, from slow everything, you know, slow conversations with people, not this shorthand texting, face-to-face, sitting down and enjoying not just eating, but the process of creating the meal. What do you think happened that we just have a shorthand now for everything?
I'm not sure when that shift happened, but I agree with you. It's happening with food and it's happened with medicine where we don't take that time anymore. And I don't know what has to happen to shift that back, but I do think talking to patients one-on-one and getting them to recognize that the slowdown is going to be very beneficial to their health, not just for their weight loss, but for their mental and spiritual health as well. And I think that connection has to happen again with people, I think that connection needs to happen again with our food and with nature. And I think people are disconnected spiritually too. So just, I'm not sure what cultural shift has to happen, but I think it needs to happen. I think if we're going to have that shift, it's going to happen from more of like an individual grassroots perspective.
I would agree with that. And I would say that it's not based, it shouldn't be based on a population model. To me, that just dumbs down the entire healthcare process, right? So you look a certain way, you come from a certain socioeconomic background. So therefore, you're going to fall into some sort of silo. And that silo, to me, usually is the worst common denominator. How can we, you know, you're going to have this medical issue, so we're going to pre-treat. We're going to drug it. We're going to try to medically manage it, but not really get to the root cause, which is an individual. It should be always individualized care.
Always.
And it seems to me that it's become templated.
So it's that almost like an algebra equation.
Exactly. But we're not, are we?
No. It's such an oversimplification that it's, you know, it's almost harmful if you oversimplify, because you stop looking at the person as a person.
You do. And then it seems to be a lot more, how do you not offend somebody, as opposed to, let's dig down to really what's going on with you. You know, it doesn't matter what walk of life you come from. You still have we're all the same in the sense that we want to be heard. Mm-hmm. We want to be able to be in a place that if we say something, no one's going to jump down our throats as if we're the problem. Mm-hmm. And even though we're doing so much now from a semantic point of view to not to coddle people and not hurt their feelings, I don't think it does a service to getting them healthy.
I agree. I think that, yeah, coddle is a good word. And just when we tiptoe around everything and we're afraid to dig in because we're afraid of offending, we really don't make any progress with people. It stays on such a surface level because you are looking at them. You're not looking at them as a person. You're looking at them as either a collection of their symptoms or whatever else. And you fail to see the person there.
I agree. And I think it gives you blind spots too. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing this module because I have to re-up my DEA, and there's a pain module. And I never really thought about this, but apparently if you're a certain race, then your pain is either over treated or under treated. But I'm like, why is that even a thing? If you were to talk to somebody and actually spend time with them, forget about what they look like, listen to them, would you really need to have this degree of parsing of this group is under treated, this group is over treated? It's just, I think it's about time and not having enough time. I remember when I was in medical school, we spent a ton of time taking the history. That was like the most important thing. And now it doesn't seem to be the case. People are inputting all sorts of information, and I don't think they're looking at the person.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that also, to a certain degree, having that screen between you and your patient, you know, us and our patients, can be a barrier too. I have patients whose doctors don't even look at them anymore because they're just looking at their screen and their keyboard. So how can you get into those layers with your patient when you don't see them? You have to engage with them and make them feel like they're not, like you're an advocate for them.
And that's how it should be. You're that desk between or the screen between. I mean, they're not going to be forthcoming because they feel guarded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you work in a system, you're trying to get to the next patient because you've got another 40 to do that day. Yeah. I mean, this whole system, it needs to be changed, and it needs to be about time and not volume. It seems as soon as the pencil pushers and the number crunchers got involved, it became, this is how many you need to see a day, and this is how many procedures you need to do, and we need to keep the bottom line going. And if you don't fit that, then you're a disruptor, or whoever didn't want to do that left. More power to them. But that means that people that are going into the system now have less choice. And have you noticed too that you're less likely to see a doctor? Like, you're more likely to see an ancillary or adjunct staff like nurse practitioner or physician assistant, and they become the front line of care mm-hmm. as opposed to the physician.
Yeah, my patients notice that. And I think, you know, I've looked at it a lot, and we're losing a lot of doctors, and either burnout or retirement. And that also, you know, I think the numbers aren't there for seeing the doctors too. So you do see those other providers, and sometimes they can take more time than the doctor can.
They can. I think that's yeah. true, but our fund of knowledge is different.
Yes, absolutely.
So yeah. you're more likely to even get more prescriptions and mm-hmm. pain medicine, et cetera, because there's less depth of knowledge, right? Yes. You can get the job done when it's straight up and straightforward, but when it becomes complicated and subtle, that's the art of medicine, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Where,
yeah.
you know, you learn that by body language, by a certain way the patient presents it. And you're like, okay, I've got a short and I've seen this before. Mm-hmm. But if you've never seen it, you're just, well, I can't help you, or I don't know. And that's not what we went to medical school for. I like Columbo, right? So I like to do a deep dive. I don't know. I'm going to go look it up and yeah. find the answer. I don't think that goes on now.
I don't think so. I know that I have the luxury of doing that with my patients because I'm a cash pay provider, right? So if I need to do homework for my patient, I get to do that. And mm-hmm. I can spend as much time, well, a lot of times I can spend as much time with my patient as they need or as I need. I'm not hemmed in that same way. So I like to do that investigation and that homework piece too. And it benefits patients in the future because how much do we get to learn? It's really, it's great.
And yeah, I mean, we're students, aren't we? And that's the whole point of going to medical school, because you would never know everything. But you would have the tools to be able to expand your knowledge base. Mm-hmm. And I think the fearlessness to know when you don't know something and work to find out the answer with the patient yeah. a lot of times. And now it's, if I don't know, it doesn't exist. I had a conversation with a patient who had an unfortunate reaction after taking a vaccine, and life-changing reaction. And she told the mm-hmm. doctor, she said, well, that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And she wouldn't take it any further. Just no, I'm not going to deal with that and move on. I actually was shocked that even happened. You couldn't really put it on anything else because nothing else was going on. And just to say poo-poo the patient and gaslight them, mm-hmm. that's where patients, if nothing else from our show, I want patients after the show to understand, if you get an answer like that, there's no reason to stay in that system. Find another doctor.
100%. Yeah. That, and I don't know where that comes from, that gaslighting and that denial. Are they worried about a liability issue? I'm not sure, but that doesn't benefit your patients. I see a lot of those patients who have been in the system for years, and they've been gaslit for years for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And when they come to see me or a doctor like me, just them being heard and knowing someone is on their side and willing to do a little bit of extra work to figure things out with them, it makes a huge difference.
I mean, you see the humanity in that kind of interaction where you just have this energy between you and the patient. A lot of times they'll start crying because somebody's mm-hmm. listening to them, and it's just, wow. I mean, you know yeah. that I'm doing exactly what I'm put on this earth to do. And when they leave feeling better, maybe not physically, but emotionally, that someone heard them. And now there's going to be someone walking with them to find an answer. You may not, but it's the process of mm-hmm. moving towards that. That's the power of healthcare, what it should be. And on that note, let's take our first break, because I think we've now set the tone for what you do and you know, the gift that you are to your patients. So let's take our first break and come back. Okay. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Amber Belt, and you can go to her website, dramberbelt.com. So it's dramberbelt.com. that's your website. It's a wealth of knowledge and resources that people can take advantage of. And I wanted to use this segment, Dr. Bell, to talk about some of the things that, that you do. I mean, things like food intolerance, for example, which I don't think people know a lot about. They just know that they may have irritable bowel or some sort of gluten intolerance. But isn't that really just a catch-all instead of looking deeper?
Yes, I think, you know, irritable bowel, anything in the gut, it's, well, first of all, the gut is such a foundational part of our health, but those symptoms are symptoms. And so we need to, why is that happening? That, you know, you're not having diarrhea because you have an Imodium deficiency. There's something happening that's irritating your gut on some level. So I think food is a reasonable and place to start, and it can, eliminating certain foods can be very healing.
Is it something that you find that you have to adjust in the patient a lot of times as your beginning of your foundation of how you treat them, whether that's blood pressure, diabetes, or GI issues?
Yeah. I use the food intolerance testing a lot because it, you know, a lot of our diseases these days arise from inflammation. So if we can get rid of that underlying source of inflammation, we know that that oxidative stress isn't going to be there. So that's so helpful for things like diabetes. It's helpful for blood pressure. I've had kids who have had ADHD bouncing off the walls in my office, and we eliminate a few key foods and their teachers are writing home about behavior improvements in school. So it's a really far-reaching thing we can do to, you know, to help benefit our health.
It's really funny that so many of these ailments you can't test for, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't see depression on a blood test or ADHD, but we seem to have a medication for all of them. Mm-hmm. And the side effects of the medication all seem to always, and I don't know, maybe it's me, but I keep hearing depression, suicidal ideation. Mm-hmm. Like most of these side effects are not what they used to be. It was rash. It was, you know, God forbid, anaphylactic, you can't breathe, but it wasn't suicidal ideation or depression or anxiety. These are major life-changing side effects, but yet they're on the market. Isn't that weird?
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. I hadn't put it together in quite that way, but yeah, you're right. Yeah. Sorry, my mind is just a little bit, you blew my mind a little bit there. Like, oh, I hadn't put it together like that. But yes, you know, if you took an antibiotic, you might get a rash or diarrhea, but yeah.
But death wasn't one of them. I mean, they tell you that death is a side effect on the commercial. That's a pretty big risk, don't you think? And it was like, okay, well, I'll just do more of it.
Yeah, let's increase your dose. Wait.
And I'm happy now. I'm getting patients asking me, you know, what's the side effect of this medication? Because they're thinkers. Mm-hmm. But most patients are like, okay. And they don't even associate sometimes the side effect. They just keep going. So it's educating the patient, but also educating our colleagues. Now, do you find that you have other physicians that you work with that really want to expand their practice and think outside the box like you? Or are you getting resistance?
Both. there are doctors who are more friendly and who do want, you know, they want to work together and do that outside the box thinking. And I have ones that completely believe what I do is quackery and nonsense and that the patient's wasting their time and their money and they don't want anything to do with, and I have patients who won't tell their doctor that they see me because they just don't want to hear the repercussions. And I'm like, well, that's not a therapeutic relationship. If you're scared to tell your doctor you're seeing any other kind of provider, that's, you probably should find another doctor.
That's a real big red flag, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
You're spending your time, your money, and your trust with people who you're afraid to tell the truth to. That, to me, is questionable. And I mean, you should love yourself enough, if you want to put it that way, that nobody gets to treat you or demean you or poo-poo you when you know your body better than anything else. I'm willing to listen to the patients. Even sometimes it's kind of strange, but they know their body better than you do. Mm-hmm. And at some point I'm like, oh, wait a minute, that makes sense. And then you come together. But it's mm-hmm. a process that, again, from our society standpoint, it takes patience. Mm-hmm. It takes empathy. It takes courage. It takes a lot of different skills from the doctor and the patient side. But man, it's awesome when it works, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I know one of the things I feel like I say to patients a lot, because I want to know how they feel in their body, especially somebody who's been chronically ill for a few decades, or gosh, even just a few years. I'm like, you live in there. You need to tell me what you're feeling, because I need to hear it all. Mm-hmm. And we can't poo-poo that and discount it. It's such valuable information.
Now, I'm going to take a little sidetrack on this, because uh-huh. you said that you were self-pay practice. And to me, that's awesome, right? That's how healthcare should be. And that's how it was before the insurance companies inserted themselves. People paid for their office visits. They might have gotten payment help with surgeries or big ticket items, but the main payment was between doctor and the patient, that fiduciary responsibility, so that they know, if I'm going to pay money, I value you, mm-hmm. right? I value your time. I value your expertise. Not somebody who's got the conflict of interest is really just ripe in the healthcare system. Yeah. Insurance companies make money when you don't use your healthcare system, your healthcare dollars, and they make money when they don't pay the doctor. Mm-hmm. Why are they even allowed to exist? Because they don't serve either side.
No, they serve themselves first and foremost. And I am always relieved I'm not working with insurance companies when I try to prescribe an inhaler for an asthmatic and that they've been on for years, and all of a sudden it's not covered. And I'm just like, what? I guess breathing's not important now.
It's very frustrating. You're blessed because going through prior authorizations and talking with somebody for approval for a procedure, or better yet, you got denied, mm-hmm. and you have to have a peer-to-peer, and your peer-to-peer is a psychiatrist. I'm ENT. So the peer-to-peer is a psychiatrist or a pediatrician. You're like, what is this?
What?
That should be just not allowed. They have no, they're just working for the company, and their mm-hmm. job is to deny you. And then they get to be the final arbiter. Forget about your medical judgment. That's irrelevant. And patients, unfortunately, don't know that, right? They think that we're the problem, and I can see why there could be burnout in our profession, because we're being thwarted. And then the patients are blaming us as if we're the root cause, like we're the cost of healthcare. And when you're private practice like you are and self-pay, that transparency, do you find that patients appreciate that? Because when they see you, they know what it's going to cost, no hidden fees, no out-of-network facility issues going on. Do you find that patients are really, they feel like it's a breath of fresh air?
I think so. And I think the accountability of paying for their visit is motivation for them. Mm-hmm. Because it's not a whatever dollar copay they're paying, it's more money out of their pocket. And so I think they're more motivated. And I don't know if this goes back to the money, but they definitely see it more as a partnership, because if I want to run lab testing, that's not covered by their insurance, because we can do that. But if I need to run any specialty testing, I am talking to them about the cost, the benefits of the test, why I want to run the test. If we get this outcome, then we can pursue this treatment plan, so you're right. There is a lot of transparency there and a lot of conversation happening that I think it just further engages the patient in their care.
Agreed. But it also, like with GoodRx and, the discount coupons online and some of the labs, if you're self-pay, like LabCorp, et cetera, it's a fraction of the cost mm-hmm. as opposed to going through your insurance. That's the biggest eye opener that patients, when you tell them, you know what, it'd be cheaper if you just pay out of pocket than getting your CT scan in a hospital where it's 10 times more money, or going to a freestanding surgery facility where they're going to give you a discount where forget, you don't even know what it is until you've done it, what the cost is in some of these systems. And, I believe in free market, right? So I mm-hmm. think that if patients could shop around, if they could say, I'm not going to have my surgery here because I can get it at this price, meet it or I'm not coming. I can imagine how we could have a pressure downward on healthcare costs just by the patient being savvy.
Yeah. I think that would be amazing. I do talk to patients about that too. When we do certain lab tests, like let's say vitamin D, for example, I'll tell them your insurance company can decide that they'll charge you $250 for this test, but my cash pay lab has it for $30. And they'll almost always opt to pay cash because they don't want to take the chance where then they're hit with this big bill.
And they will be hit. And sometimes it's out of network, right? So if the pathologist, if you get a biopsy, the doctor's in network, everything except the pathologist, and you won't know that, or the anesthesiologist, for example, in surgery, and then you get nailed with a major bill because they're not in network. So, I mean, it's all this manipulation of cost, but there's a middleman in all of this, whether it's the pharmacy benefit people for the medications or the supplies they have, you know, purchasing agents for them. It's just all this layer upon layer cost that somebody's taking that money. And it's not the doctor, 9 times out of 10, because they're on a salary, it's not them.
Right.
It's this system. And the patients have this mindset that if it's bigger, then it must be better and cheaper. And that is the absolute opposite.
Right. It is. Yeah.
So I know we're going to take a break in a minute, but I want to open up by asking about the major chronic diseases, because they seem to be running rampant. I saw an article or listened to a video actually of how obesity is becoming so huge, like almost 1 in 2 children, for example, are pre-diabetic. Just some crazy number where there's something going on in the system that is causing disease. Are you seeing a growth or even more people coming through your practice with younger and younger folks with chronic disease?
Yes, definitely. I think even it's a difference even from probably 15 years ago. I think also 15 years ago, my practice was more heavily pediatric than it is now. So I saw a lot more healthy kids coming through. And now it does seem like they are bigger. They're overweight or obese. And a lot of them they have issues with their blood sugar and they have ADHD. And it seems like they have so many layers of issues going on that I think for the parents and for the kids, it's almost like climbing a mountain to get back to health. It almost seems impossible.
Well, that's really tragic, isn't it?
It is.
They're supposed to be the healthiest parts of our society. If they're starting off ill as a preteen or younger, what kind of life are they going to live as an adult, do you think?
Yeah, it's a rough one. It's hard to reverse. I mean, you know, you kind of have that set point, especially with your weight. You set that in childhood and adolescence. So if you go into that overweight or obese, it becomes really hard to reverse that. So you're just getting set up for a lifetime of all the complications we know of from diabetes and insulin resistance and all of those terrible consequences. So I really think we have our work cut out for us with kids.
Are the parents, they're seeing you, so they must be amenable to diet and working on doing what you need to do. Every choice you make has to be towards your health or away from it. You have to make conscious choices. But it seems to me that the majority of parents may not be on that train. It's just if the Ozempic is offered, they're going to take it for their child. And they're trying to get it approved, I think, for young children, which is tragic. I mean, you're going to be on that for 50, 60, 70 years. I mean, does that even make sense?
I don't think that makes sense. And, you know, a lot of times I think parents have really good intentions, but they just don't have the follow through because it's such a battle and everyone is so, I mean, like we were talking about before, trying to move so quickly and get so much done. And it's the follow through isn't there. And it doesn't make sense to have kids on, you know, high dose semaglutide, Ozempic or Wegovy forever. And even what I see when those drugs are prescribed for adults or the peptides are prescribed for adults, is there's no conversation about changing diet or or upping the exercise, exactly like we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, they're not talking about that. And so if they do get off of the Ozempic and they keep eating what they're eating, they're just going to gain all that back, but probably have less muscle mass in the meantime.
And I would say, and I'm going to take we got a few minutes before I take the break, mm-hmm. but that means inflammation becomes a root cause to this child. And mm-hmm. we know inflammation, as you said at the beginning of the show, is kind of the foundation for pretty much every disease out there, including cancer, right? Including aging, premature mm-hmm. aging. And gosh, the list is kind of endless. Yeah. So from an inflammatory standpoint, what are the three things that you tell folks that come in to stop that process, to get yourself off that inflammatory train? Because that's the beginning of getting your power back and your health.
Yeah. If I had to pick three things, I think the first thing we talk about is food. And because you can, like, I liked what you said, you can either make choices for your health or against your health. And I was recording a webinar for some folks today, and we were talking about seasonal illness and, you know, eating for your health or against your health immune-wise. And so we start there a lot because that's the foundation of a lot of inflammation. I think I also spend a lot of time with patients on their gut health, because so much of our immune system is seated in the gut. So a lot of inflammation can come from the gut. Yeah. So food, the gut, and honestly, stress is a huge source, I think, for people that keeps them inflamed, because then they don't sleep and then they make poor food choices. So we talk a lot about stress modulation and trying to get them back on track, stress-wise too.
I would absolutely agree. And everybody's staying up later, either playing mm-hmm. video games, watching TV, snacking. I think COVID was the worst in terms of that. People had horrible habits.
And the amount of alcohol people were drinking. Oh my gosh.
Anything to like get over and get by. But now people are paying the price for that. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's like a domino effect, right? The first bad choice you make, and probably the easiest two things, and now we're going to take a break, but I would start with the question, the first two things, if you could do anything, would it be drinking water and sleeping? And I'll let you answer that when we come back. So those two things, I want to know if those things foundationally would be, if you had to pick two, would those put you closer to moving in the right direction? So let's take our second break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living a Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Amber Belt. And again, her website is dramberbelt.com. And she also has a podcast, Rural Roots Homestead Health. And I want to ask you about that after I get the answer to my question about water and sleep. Mm-hmm. You know, if we were going to bed at a reasonable time, we wouldn't be snacking in the middle of the night, would we?
Right, exactly. And that that break was so well timed, because I was thinking about it. I was like, yes, those can be life-changing, because we won't snack in the middle of the night, but also when we sleep, we're, you know, our cortisol and other hormones are better regulated. So we're not set up to ride the blood sugar roller coaster. And so we're able to make better choices about what we eat. And if we're hydrated, we're not going to, you know, we'll also make a lot better choices. Our brains are going to work better. Drinking water and sleeping are huge.
And is water, all water created equally? I've had people who use the little one-stage filters versus their refrigerator versus, God knows, hopefully not tap water. Mm-hmm. But is it a marketing thing, or is alkaline water really medicinal?
I think I have had some people feel better with alkaline water, but I never know if that's because they're drinking water or if it's because of the alkalinity of the water. So I think a lot of the benefits are marketing and overstated to get you to buy a product. But it's a cleaner water than what you're getting out of the tap. And if it helps people drink water, it's go for it.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I think it tastes better to me than the mm-hmm. regular bottled water, but would it make a difference in terms of what they're drinking it out of then, whether it's one of those BPA plastic things or it's BPA free?
Yeah, I think, boy, so BPA free is better, but there's also other types of bisphenols that are in plastic, even if it is BPA free. So if you can drink it out of glass or out of stainless steel, those are going to be even better choices. Okay. I'm not a huge fan of drinking out of plastic or storing food in plastic if we can help it.
What about microwave?
You know, I don't have a microwave. I got rid of mine. I think the potential is there to, it superheats the food, and I don't like what it does for the nutrients in the food. Mm-hmm. So we ditched ours it was only about a year ago, and we got a little toaster oven air fryer combo. And mm-hmm. I only miss it when I'm trying to heat up my little rice bag that I'll put on my neck when my neck gets sore. But otherwise, mm-hmm. I think it tastes better. It just comes out a lot better.
I think you're right. I'm used to, for years now, I've not popped any popcorn in one of those microwave things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, you're on vacation in a hotel or something. That's the nastiest stuff I've ever had.
It really is.
Gross. I mean, you have this taste in the back of your tongue. I mean, people don't even know what good is. And, mm-hmm. and that goes for fast food as well, right? Because we don't know what's in that. We don't know what shortcut they're using, what oils they're using. And that's my second question. Are all oils created equally? I mean, I'm hearing now that you should stay away from seed oil because it's not great for you. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that the hyper-processed seed oils can be a driver of inflammation. So I think that there is a movement now to kind of get back to those traditional fats that we've cooked with, you know, like tallow and lard. And I think you can get good seed oils. I use a cold pressed sunflower seed oil. Sometimes it's from a local, I'm in Kansas, and it's from a farm in Kansas, and they process it there. So I think you can get those oils in a healthy way, but I think the mass produced ones you have to be careful about.
Gotcha. And so we had a brief conversation about inflammation, mm-hmm. but so you're saying diet can drive it. I assume stress can drive it.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from sleeping and eating properly, are there any other strategies that people can use? Like maybe, what was it, medium chain fats, like, you know, coconut oil or something like that. Is there anything that can neutralize or somehow be antioxidant and not just vitamins, but foods?
Yeah. You know, so the diet that I will oftentimes recommend to patients if we're looking to decrease inflammation would be a Mediterranean diet, because that, I mean, if you look, and I say this all the time, I tell patients just eat food that looked like it did when it came from the farm. So I think the thing that those two diets have in common is just whole foods, just eating actual food. So we're mm-hmm. getting plenty of fruits and vegetables. We're getting meat that's not been toyed with and who knows what. We're eating, you know, if you can tolerate dairy, it's a good whole food. Beans and grains. I think people tend to go overboard on grains. So I usually tell them to minimize their grain consumption. Mm-hmm. But if we can just eat actual food and not, you know, I call fast food and processed foods, I always tell patients those are really food-like products. And you're not getting the nutrients out of them, but you're also getting a lot of other byproducts that are going to promote inflammation.
And from the standpoint of vitamins, again, there's markets out there. I mean, you know, you've got your one-a-days and your Centrums and that sort of thing. But one, are vitamins necessary? And if so, which kind should you use? Should they be liquid? Should you, you know, use whole vitamins? How would you, mm-hmm. for people who need to take them? first of all, is it worth it?
I think for a lot of people, because the other thing that we encounter is even if we're eating a lot of fruits and vegetables, the soils are pretty depleted mineral wise and, you know, compared to what they used to be. I was at a lecture once and the lecturer was going over data from, I believe it was from the USDA from the 30s and then from more modern times. Mm-hmm. And the amount of nutrients in the fruits and vegetables was a lot less. So I think a lot of people can benefit from a multivitamin. I think to a certain degree, you get what you pay for. So if you look at like a Centrum or something like that, there sometimes you'll find ingredients like nickel in there and that's not a mineral you want. That's, you know, there's toxicity to that. So you just need to be careful about where you source those things from. I think the health food store is going to have better options for people.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, but I think, and then, you know, for my patients, we'll hone in on certain, if we can identify certain deficiencies, we'll plug in. I like to do food first, but while we're incorporating food, you know, we might do an extra, I'm trying to think, like we'll do extra vitamin D supplementation or we'll do B12 supplementation, things like that. And the form of the vitamin, liquid versus like a tablet or a capsule, I'm not hung up on any one of those really. I think with tablets, I just need to make sure that they're going to dissolve in the digestive tract and that they don't have a big coating on them so that that it's exiting. I don't want it to exit the system the same way it went into the system.
Understood. But it's so many things out there. It's hard to, I think for patients, they get so much stimulation, but the natural side is not really stimulated, you know, in terms of being self-healing. I think the body can help itself if you give it the building blocks. And it's all about something, you know, manufactured or not natural. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I noticed that you have a first aid kit, which it's natural and natural products based, which is really, it's unique. Because everybody's thinking I need to pile up on my bacitracin or whatever the heck they're using. But there's a lot of natural things. People think about viruses and they don't really understand that they could hit them hard with things like elderberry or zinc or vitamin D. And that's what your kit contains. So it's not only that, but you have pain, things for pain as well, right?
There's a lot of things we can do naturally that I think people just don't recognize. And, you know, a viral infection and an acute injury, those are things that we're used to, like, you know, popping ibuprofen for, both of them, because you're trying to suppress a fever, which we really shouldn't be doing anyways, but, or you're trying to calm down that inflammation. But in those cases, you actually kind of want that inflammation. And so the herbs can really work with your body to modulate that and to, you know, to help your body heal.
It's interesting though, how everybody, not everybody, but the way the narrative goes, that you just are at the mercy of whatever happens to you. You don't have anything that you can do to intervene or stop the propagation. Like for a virus example, I use for our patients, you know, the virus hits the cell and it replicates in the cell and then it bursts out and it keeps infecting other cells. But if you do things like vitamin C and zinc and D, you can arrest that. You can stop it in its tracks. You can lock the virus in the cell and let the body finish the process of healing you. And they're just like happy. They don't even know this exists. But it's the body's an amazing creation by God. It's so resilient. It's amazing we assaulted so much and it's still able to help us, isn't it?
It's incredible. And I sometimes, you touched on it before, but sometimes all we need to do is give the body what it needs to heal and just get out of the way. And then, you know, we have such a huge capacity to heal. I mean, I'm sure you have too. I've just seen some incredible things happen and you can't underestimate it, but I think we do all the time.
I think we do. And unfortunately, people want a fast fix, but nothing you know, as I said at the beginning of the show, you have to work for things. It doesn't just happen out of a vacuum. And all the medicines that we prescribe, because I still do, but I know that there's an end point to them. If someone comes in with heartburn or reflux, that's not omeprazole land or whatever forever. You have to figure out, are you digesting your food? Do you have an inflammatory process? Do you have small bacterial, small bowel bacterial overgrowth? All these other things that no one seems to think about. So when you mention it and you're like, oh, there's something you can do to not have it and not take a medicine forever, that's like you, you know, the patients just light up when they understand that.
They do. And they really do. And I think that that willingness, it's just funny because when you said the small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, it occurs to me that I've brought that up to patients and they'll bring it up to their provider and they said, oh, my doctor doesn't believe in that, as if that overgrowth is this matter of faith. And it's like, but we have testing for that. I don't understand why you wouldn't want to dig deeper. But I think really what it speaks to is the amount of possibilities or the amount of opportunity that we do have to heal, because there are many roads to healing and lots of causes we can look at to help.
And that's exciting. I mean, that may, every day you go to work, you don't do the same thing, do you?
No, uh-uh.
That's cool, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, someday, yeah, I think there are some common threads, but I never do the same thing every day.
No, because everybody's different. So if you can figure out how, maybe it's verbally, you know, just listening, maybe it's giving them a natural approach instead of doing something like, you know, Tums for their heartburn or, you know, things that, you know, there may be a lot of ways for them to open their minds to it. But I really am waiting for this next connection, right? I want patients to be able to see a doctor like you or me who thinks outside the box and then take that back to their physician. And if they get that blank stare or I don't believe in this, then you tell them why you're leaving their practice.
Yes.
See,
exactly.
Educate them because they only understand, you know, I don't know what they understand because it's very, how do you want to go to work and you don't get anybody better? I don't want that. To me, that's not what I'm, why I became a doctor. So I really don't understand the mindset of, let me just give you 10 other drugs and you have a side effect, so I'm going to put another one on. And oh, well, that just seems to be wrong. But unless the doctor, unless we can educate, be the go-between in a sense, between our patients who finally get it and have them go back to their physician and you know, lay down the law. You know, I'm not taking it. This is why I'm not taking it. Why don't you know that you can do X, Y, and Z? Put them on the spot. There's nothing wrong with that, right?
No.
It should go the opposite way.
Yeah. And if the doctor is not receptive to having that conversation, I agree. It's a red flag and you should find someone else.
Absolutely agree.
I actually created a handout it's a free handout I created, and it's about navigating it's called Navigating the Medical Matrix, but it's basically how to vet a provider, especially if you're going into a new provider. So you can try to find somebody who aligns with you better so that you can maybe even avoid that experience of having to, it's awful to have to switch providers because you got to start from scratch, right? So So if we can get people better at vetting their doctors, maybe they can find a better fit.
I love that. How can they access that information?
I believe I have it on my website. If it's not, I'll put it up there.
I think that's awesome because that empowers patients. They can have basically a script almost and not feel intimidated and put the doctor on the spot. They just seem to run roughshod over patients sometimes without consequence. But I don't believe these palaces, these academic centers would work the way they are why they're working now, because they seem to be the only game in town. They've done a bang up job of removing primary care and independent practices, just pricing us out and making it as hard as possible and becoming the only game in town from a legislative point of view. For us as a surgeon, they stopped having for a while. You can open up your own surgery center because there was competition to the hospital. So they put a kibosh on that. So anything that's going to be an another choice that's counter to them or puts economic pressure or even just market share on them, they've been very mercenary about taking that, removing that barrier or removing that alternative. Mm-hmm. But they can't tell the patients what to do, can they? So
no,
if the patient
has
their own decision, they can work around it, and we're here ready to help them. They just need to take that first step.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for the patient standing up and saying that you're not going to tolerate that. So I think one of the things that I try to do with my patients is really empower them to do that, to, you know, to stand, to take that stand if they need to.
Agreed. And I love what you do. And I really am. I'm blessed to have you on the show because it's so nice to be around somebody who's like-minded,
yes.
But not just like-minded, but you put it into practice, which I think is amazing. And unfortunately, time goes so fast when we do these interviews, but I want to make sure that people know how to get to your website, how to listen to your podcast. And you have a Substack page as well, right?
Mm-hmm. I do. So the website's dramberbelt.com. And I think you have to put the www in front of that. With the way the things worked out, you can find my Substack under Dr. Amber Belt. And that's where I host my podcast too. Yeah. And then I do a lot of posting on Instagram too. And the same Dr. Amber Belt.
Well, it's just that I'm looking at your website. You can empower people how to fill their medicine cabinet. So they have mm-hmm. things that actually are helping them instead of not. And you know, the testing that you recommend, I think that's really neat that you can go outside of the typical testing, you know, modules that we offer and get more information about your cellular level, about how your body works, because it's all about knowledge, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that Schoolhouse Rock that you say knowledge is power. It's true.
I'd love to have you come back because I think we just scratched the surface because we didn't get to talk about other chronic diseases, but I think it's a really good primer so people can expand their mind and find your show and listen to it because what you say is important and you're adding benefit to everybody. So I want to thank you again for joining me today. It was an absolute honor and a pleasure.
Thank you so much. I would love to come back.
Great. And I will call you. Don't worry.
Okay.
So have a great day. And I want to again thank you and thank you everybody for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.